You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, September 30th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
How's everybody doing today?
Pretty good.
Okay.
I'm tired. I slept all day because I got home from my Sweden trip today.
Yumpin' yimini.
Yeah, so by the time I got home at like 2 in the afternoon, and I had like something to eat, and I passed out, and I woke up at 7 o'clock.
Half of us are sleep-deprived. Hopefully it won't come through the podcast.
Rebecca is so sleep-deprived she's not here. She wasn't feeling well. She was feeling under the weather tonight, so she didn't even make it. But Evan, tell us what is significant about this day in history.
If anything.
Yeah, there are a few significant things about this day in history. In 1954, the world's first nuclear submarine, the USS Nautilus. Was commissioned at Groton, Connecticut. Just a stone's throw from here.
So it was launched on this day?
It was commissioned. I guess that means they took the bottle of champagne and smashed it against the submarine.
It wasn't a secret launch? Do you remember? I don't remember.
I don't think it was a secret launch, but it was on its mission, I believe, was a secret mission. It was to
seek out new life
and new civilizations.
Evan, do they have footage of the submarine launching?
Yes,
it's gone before.
Or did they erase it?
You mean like NASA erased the tapes of?
I know what you're saying. I know where you're going with that.
Nice,
Steve.
Nice segue.
Well, Jay, tell us, give us a little bit of an update on the footage of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon.
This is awesome, guys. Listen to this. There is new unseen footage of the historic Apollo 11 moon landing that we all love and know that shows Neil Armstrong descending a ladder to the surface of the moon. And they found this footage and they digitally remastered it. So the story behind this is that the original signal was captured at three different stations: the Goldstone in California, the Honeysuckle Creek in Canberra, and Parks in New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what was happening was they were broadcasting the signal from the moon from one or two different cameras, and these signals were being captured and then on magnetic tape being recorded on Earth. So then, as you all know, time goes by. Sadly, NASA wiped their copies of the tapes. There was about 250,000 tapes from the Apollo era, including 45 tapes of the moonwalk that are probably lost forever. What happened was, in the 80s, someone made a bootleg copy of the video that was captured at Honeysuckle Creek. A copy of that copy was given to an Apollo enthusiast, and that copy was tracked down to being in Sydney by the search team that was looking for video, and this video was the only one that we have that actually would be considered higher quality or high enough quality where we really can see some clear pictures of Neil Armstrong.
Wow.
Now, the search for these tapes, and they knew that the Australian astronomers knew that there were tapes. They knew that they had tapes. They didn't know where they were. So about 10 years ago, an extensive search was started, and that search was headed up by an astronomer and telescope operator named John Sarkisian.
Sarkisian.
Sarkisian. Who's located in Parks in New South Wales. So it's really, he's the guy that made this happen. So he finds these tapes, he tracks down this bootleg of a bootleg tape, and even that wasn't in good condition because I guess that dated back to the 80s, so they had to digitally remaster it. And they came up with some really fantastic video. So they got about 3 minutes of video. And that video will be shown exclusively at the 2010 Australian Geographic Society Awards in Sydney on October 6th. And Buzz Aldrin's going to be the guest of honor.
But then they'll make it more widely available, right? They're just going to premiere it there, I'm assuming.
Yeah, John said that NASA may soon release the full video. I'm sure they're going to release it right away.
Yeah.
Just so everyone can see it.
They're still not off the hook for erasing all those tapes, but it's good that they at least tracked this down.
They'll never live that down.
I wonder if Buzz is going to punch someone.
Now, Evan, there's been some rumors flying around this past week that the UN either has or is about to appoint an alien ambassador, meaning an ambassador from the UN to space aliens.
This made big headlines this week, as you can imagine. I mean, that's a significant position. You could look at it that way. Yeah, you
also, could it could be a pretty easy job, too, when you think about it.
That's right. I'll just kick back and wait for that to happen.
Yeah.
Kind of a sinecure.
Wake me when the aliens get here.
Yeah, at least that was the initial report by, I believe it was the UK Daily Telegraph that reported the appointment of this person to serve that role, to be the official sort of spokesperson in case the aliens, you know, do one day in any of our lifetimes come and visit us, and that this person would be the official meet and greet.
But Evan, is this like, is this guy going to be sitting around at a desk with a, you know, with the title meet and greeter of the aliens, and until that happens, nothing goes on in that guy's office?
It's a good point, Jay. And then when the once the story got out about it and further news reporting was done on it, it actually turns out that that's not exactly the truth.
Meaning it's wrong.
Yeah. It seems to be some sort of an exaggeration. So this spokesperson for Earth, when asked by reporters directly about it, said, absolutely not. No, there's nothing to that story. This person, Maslin Othman, who is the head of UN's Office for Outer Space Affairs and who is also going to be speaking at a Royal Society meeting next week about the political impacts of an alien encounter.
The political impact?
The political impacts of an alien encounter.
Right.
That's part of it.
Guys, does this all sound like total creepy, stupid bullshit to you?
Right, but the thing is, that was misinterpreted, or just through the rumor mill, was changed into a UN ambassador to aliens. But it's nothing to do with that.
No, it's nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
She's an astrophysicist.
Yeah.
And she is called upon, basically, for her expertise when it comes to opinions on projects, for example, like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and so forth. And she informs the United Nations about what's going on with projects such as that and keeps them up to date on other...
Yeah, that's perfectly legitimate.
Absolutely, it is legitimate.
But it just sounded to me like the way you said it, that it's almost like they're creating like this new job for someone to sit there and basically be like the meet and greet, you know, bringing out hors d'oeuvres for the aliens when the time comes.
And so, you know, I mean, we all have this Hollywood vision of this. You know, you can't help but bring up Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I happen to enjoy. I think it's an excellent movie. But for as far as entertainment goes, as far as its plausibility goes and how that could, it would actually never happen that way if we were to really have some kind of alien encounter. It was Carl Sagan who said that, first of all, if aliens are visiting Earth, there's going to be absolutely no doubt about what's going on. There's going to be no secrecy. There's going to be no cover-ups or anything going on like that. It is going to be about as blatant as anything else is going to be. Plus, you know, we have no way of knowing why they've come. I doubt to make communication with humans on the Earth. They're probably, you know, who knows why they would visit, and who knows if they're even in a means that we could ever possibly have any kind of communication, of any meaningful communication with them.
So we tend
to think of these things from a very human perspective when it comes to what else is out there in the universe.
One interesting thing about this whole affair is the UFO conspiracy sites all abuzz, you know, with this rumor, which they totally ran with, and some even speculating, like, are we on the brink of the world governments admitting that aliens are among us? Is this just a prelude to that? They're always waiting for that revelation right around the corner, and they're going to – it just never, never comes.
Well, David Icke, you're going to have to wait, I guess, until the next time. Sorry.
Right.
David Icke, of course, believes that aliens are already amongst us and have have disguised themselves as humans and are currently occupying the highest seats of power in governments all over the world.
Yeah.
Nicely insulating himself from
reality.
Reality. How do you test that? Like, oh, well, he looks human.
Of course he does.
Alien, though.
Yeah, of course he does. That just proves he's alien. There was another report out recently about how terrible science education is in the United States. This one also saying that poor science education is actually stagnating the American economy. This was released last Thursday at a congressional briefing. This is an update to a 2005 science education report. Among the main findings were, for example, that the United States ranks 48th worldwide in K through 12 in mathematics. Here's a funny one. I think we've reported the same statistic previously. 49% of U.S. adults did not know how long it takes for the Earth to circle the sun.
Wow.
Ouch.
God damn.
That's harsh. Like,
really?
How is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote about this, I mean, that seems like an isolated, you know, point of trivia. But really what that means is that if you don't have a basic idea that, you know, the Earth goes around the sun in a year, you don't really have a working model of the universe in your head. Right?
Yeah.
You don't care. And you're incurious.
That's a good point, Bob. Ignorance is bliss to those people, right? Yeah, they just absolutely could give two cruds.
Like, if they don't know that, what else do they don't know?
Yeah. I mean, they might not be stupid people. They may have their areas of intelligence or interest. But clearly, they never had any passion or interest in science in general.
Or curiosity, yeah.
I mean, you know, at some point you develop an internal model of the world that you live in. You know, you have some idea of where you are in the world. You know, that's also that. To me, that's like on the level of like not knowing what countries border the United States, you know, or whatever country
Steve,
you live
careful.
In.
Careful, you start asking people about that. You ask them to point out states on a map. Or you start
that's what
pointing
I'm saying.
Out countries
it's,
on the map.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing how
it's
bad.
Terrible. Yeah, and you know, we have conversations with people all the time where they confuse solar system and galaxy and universe. Like those terms are just used interchangeably. Like they have it's just all a big mishmash. They have no idea,
space,
you know, how space is actually, you know, constructed. It's interesting. But, you know, clearly we're not doing a good job in science education. And I also don't think it's one thing. I don't think it's any one thing. I think it's a combination of things, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that – and I've been very closely following my daughter's science education in public schools. And, you know, we live in Connecticut. It actually is a pretty affluent state and has a pretty good public education system. So, you know, I think that the education here is representative of the higher end, you know, of public education in this country. And I have consistently been unimpressed by the level of science education my daughters are getting. You know, I don't know what you feel, Bob, but about your daughter's education. But, you know, the stuff they bring home, the stuff they're doing, they're often are not even going off a reasonable textbook or any textbook. They're doing kind of superficial projects. And there seems to be, I don't know, it seems to be a bit hollow. There's like there's something missing.
My takeaway is a little bit better than yours, though. I don't feel quite as not as disappointed as you. I've been happy with the level of detail they're being taught. Yeah, some of the projects aren't. I mean, there hasn't been too many of them, but I'm generally happy and with her interested in, and her grades as well. But yeah, I see what you're saying.
This is just anecdotal, our personal experience. The fact is, the statistics don't lie. I mean, we're not getting the job done when. P.Z. Myers wrote about it. Now, he's a college professor. He gets students into his biology class. And, again, this is his experience, and this may be more to do with an effect of just getting older or progressing in your profession. But he thinks that students are coming to him much less prepared in science than they were in years past, that he perceives that it's getting much worse.
He's got a good perspective.
Yeah. Where is this slide-off happening, and how does it happen?
You know, I think a lot of it is that, you know, teachers who are not specialty trained in science are able to teach science. You know, you just need to – there's more of a focus on teaching how to teach than the material of what you're supposed to be teaching. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the education culture, and I just don't think it's serving well. I remember, like, when I was in grade school, the teachers who were teaching science were science teachers.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right.
Right.
And now, and I've dealt directly with a lot of the teachers, you know, a lot of my daughter's teachers. I've lectured for them, for example, for their class. And they're not science teachers. They're just general teachers who may or may not have any interest in science. So it's totally hit or miss.
Depending on the grade, too. You know, I remember
where I would have like three teachers, and each one of them covered 2 to 4 subjects.
I mean, for you know, I pretty much have taken over my daughter's science education, so I'm not worried about them. But I mean, it's not all bad. I mean, obviously they're, you know, they're getting some information from school, which is useful. But it seems to be a lot farther behind what I where I remember being in grade school.
A lot of it also, Steve, is the actual – the teacher, the personality of the teacher.
Yes.
Remember Mr. Coffin from Canterbury was such a great teacher, such a quirky, funny guy, dry sense of humor. And, you know, it's hard to you know, to find people like that. And my daughter had a really good science teacher recently. And
yeah.
It's just something like that.
Oh, I agree.
Really,
I think it's
trained.
I think it's 90% the individual teacher. I absolutely agree. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we need more emphasis on – giving teachers the extra education in science, right? I don't think that just knowing how to teach is enough. I think you need to know science in order to teach it well.
I think we should award our teachers for excellence. I think we should. I've had quite a few excellent teachers in my day, and they're the ones that I remember. And of course, I learned more in those classes. And
teachers' unions don't like that, though. They don't want any kind of merit pay or reward because
it's become so unionized.
Yeah,
it's really become a problem. It's institutionalized at this point, and you can't break through.
And I said it before. I think that we need to get actual practicing scientists more involved in designing the curriculum, and. You know, students need to be taught a functional body of knowledge, not just facts, not just disconnected facts. It has to build upon itself, and they have to see how it's useful to have this knowledge and how it applies to the real world. And what I see is the kind of projects that they do, and even sometimes where the information is presented, it's like, well, what is the use of that? You know, that's not what's actually happening in the real world.
Right.
You know?
I think it's also important, Steve, to see how the sciences fit and work together.
Yes. Like this is interesting because, you know, one of my daughters is in second grade, and, you know, we recently reviewed the curriculum with the teachers. And with they're breaking up the curriculum, first of all, she's getting like 1 hour of science every other week, something like that, which
what?
I think is way too little.
Wow.
Way too little.
Oh,
even if for second grade, it was like it wasn't even its own slot per week. It was shared with other things. And so that's one problem. But also they're going to teach 3 topics, but they're going to like focus on one topic for a third of the year and then shift to another topic. And I think we just recently discussed, you know, research showing that it's actually better if you mix it up, if you show how it all works together and go back and forth rather than teach one thing in complete isolation, then you go on to the next thing. They never see how that fits into any kind of broader view of reality or science.
That goes for all subjects, though, Steve.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree.
So, I mean, obviously, it's a very complicated issue. There's no easy fix. But I do think that we need to take – not just throw more resources at it. I think that we probably do need more resources. But we need to take a very thoughtful approach, look at the research that's out there, and take a real evidence-based approach to improve science education in this country. Because by every measure, you know, we're not doing a good job. So, Bob, I want you to tell me about a news item that we actually have touched upon before, but there's been a bit of an update. Some news outlets are reporting that NASA may have discovered a new force of nature.
Yeah, the Pioneer anomaly is back in the news. We talked about that a while back. Some think it's its resolution may require a new fundamental force in nature beyond the ones we know, like gravity, electroweak, and strong forces. Have you guys heard of the Pioneer anomaly? Well, even if you have, I'm going to tell you about it. Way back in 1980, scientists noticed that the twin Pioneer probes, these are the probes that that checked out Jupiter and Saturn, among other things, at the opposite ends of the solar system, were not where they should have been. For each year that they traveled out there at the outskirts of the solar system, they were closer to the sun than they should have been by a distance equal to about the width of the United States, about 3,000 miles. Now, that's not much when you think that these probes travel 250 million miles a year. I mean, what's 3,000 miles to 250 million miles? Not much, but these distances and velocity calculations are so refined that even that tiny percentage of error is such an anomaly that I was just screaming for an explanation. But nothing that they looked at, though, could explain this kind of weird deceleration. For example, they looked at the potential for significant errors in computation. That's always a possibility, right? You're just doing the math wrong.
Yeah.
Human error.
That wasn't considered likely since 7 independent analyses show the effect. They looked at the drag from the interplanetary medium, including dust and cosmic rays, but the measured densities were too small to cause this effect. They also looked at the outgassing from the spacecraft, or what I call the flatulent hypothesis, and that was ruled out. Another one was gravitational forces, which is kind of an obvious one a lot of people think of. You know, perhaps there's some unidentified sources in the Kuiper Belt, or maybe there's dark matter. But if that was true, then you would see the effect in the outer planets. There would be errors, there would be anomalies in their orbits as well, and that didn't pan out. And then another one, which I wasn't aware of, some scientists, and this makes sense, they thought it was just a quirk of the Pioneer design itself, and that seems like a pretty reasonable idea. But other probes, like Galileo and Ulysses, are also showing this anomaly, and they have different designs. So pretty perplexing issue they're trying to deal with. But I read some wacky stuff about this. I thought I should mention. One of them really stood out. This was a report on CNN International. It seemed to me to be a classic example of the trend of using, you know, people that are unfamiliar with science to cover science stories. The title, of course, of this one story I came across is so typical. It's a cliche. Mystery Force in Space Baffles NASA. it had to throw that word in there. Here's a good quote. This guy says that the spacecraft, which is currently 11 billion kilometers away from Earth, now only travels at 25 centimeters every day going backwards. So I read that. I'm like, what's this guy talking about? He makes it sound like the probe is just moving backwards 25 centimeters a day. And of course he means that it doesn't progress as much as it should in the course of a day by 25 centimeters or whatever it is. And I actually found the article that he based that on, and he completely twisted it around, and he presented that information just so poorly. But the best quote was, he says that defying all previously known theories about the universe, I love when they start with that, the strange force that gently pushes spacecraft away from outer space was...
What?
Yeah. Yeah, let's take that one just as it is. This force that pushes spacecraft away from outer space. Now, was this a kid writing this? I mean, well, I don't get that. Away, so what? So it's pushing it at right angles to reality. Is that it, into another dimension? How do you push away from outer space? All right, whatever. So that could be a typo or something silly. But it said this was discovered last year. No, it was, you know, in 1980. So, you know, 30 years ago. Not last year. Close, though.
Fail.
And then when the spacecraft Pioneer 10 was stopped in its path by the unknown phenomenon. Stopped it. So this probe just stopped.
Beep.
Like in a cartoon.
Like a traffic signal.
Comes into a screeching stop in space. Like,
red,
whoa, what's going on here? So yeah, that's just really the most horrific science reporting I have ever seen in my entire life.
Wow, Bob.
Pushing away from outer space.
That's pretty bad.
So, yeah. Anyway, this latest wrinkle, though, in all of this is that some new research will be appearing soon in the Physical Review that could potentially add support to the notion that there's a new fundamental force in nature that's responsible for this. Now, the details are frustratingly sparse right now. I really looked everywhere, and there's very little mention of the actual details of what they're doing. But this a new force in nature, that would be pretty monumental discovery. Even if it's a lot weaker than gravity, and gravity is, if you probably know the weakling of all forces. It's so weak that at atomic scales, you can pretty much just ignore it in your calculations. It's so negligible. And the only reason, of course, that it shapes the universe is the fact that it can act over long distance, unlike a lot of these other forces. Except electromagnetism, of course. The anomaly appears to be 10 billion times weaker than gravity, so you might think it's completely inconsequential, but it could have actually tangible effects on Earth. Like, for example, it could affect the amount of comets that hurtle towards the Earth over the course of extremely long periods of time, of course. It's not like this force is going to send, 1,000 comets towards the Earth, but over time, it could actually have an impact. But, so follow this one. This one could be interesting. That would probably be a Nobel Prize if somebody finds a new force and could actually really verify it.
But so. Bob, if this is actually a new force, if that's the explanation for the Pioneer anomaly,
yeah,
wouldn't we be seeing its effects on other objects in the solar system, like every asteroid we track? Maybe you could say, all right, the force is so weak that it's not going to affect the orbit of Jupiter measurably, but we're tracking some pretty small asteroids, right? Wouldn't that have an effect on them?
Yeah, you know, I see what you're saying. Maybe the difference, Steve, is that they are in orbit around the sun, and these probes are leaving the solar system. So maybe could that be a factor? I'm not sure if that would have an impact. It's not really in orbit around the sun.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only thing I could think of. But yeah, you would think something like this, would, you know, as subtle as it is, we might have detected it. But I mean, we're seeing it in other probes. We're seeing a similar anomaly in probes that actually that come back to the Earth. You know, for to get these gravitational boosts and things. We're seeing some unusual things happening with probes that come back to the Earth. Although that might be a separate phenomena. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
But, Bob, why is it that big of a deal for us to find a yet undiscovered force that's out there? You know, isn't it a big presumption of our of us to say we've discovered every, you know, every force there is in the universe? I mean, why, it doesn't seem to me to be that shocking to, for them to come up with something else that, that's happening.
I don't know. I disagree. I mean, a fundamental force...
It's fundamental.
Affects stuff, right? I mean, the thing is we've been looking at how matter interacts with other matter and how things move around the universe. We've been, you know, observing it in very detail, making predictions. And those predictions have been extremely accurate. So this is a genuine anomaly. It's off by a little bit from what we predict. That's a big deal. That doesn't happen frequently.
Right.
And I'm not saying it's not a big deal, but at the same time, you know, like what we're seeing under pretty unique circumstance here, right? Like we're looking at something that's been traveling for X number of years in a direction.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that, and I agree, it's not surprising that there might be another force out there if it turns out that the force is extremely weak.
Mm. Right.
Because we can't ever prove that there is no new force, right? All we could say is if there are any forces out there that we haven't discovered, they have to be weaker than any of our attempts at measuring them.
So far, yeah.
So far. So that which seems to fit this scenario where you're talking about something that's, what was it, Bob, a billion times weaker than gravity?
Yeah, something like 10 billion times.
10 billion times. So that's weak. Really weak force. That's the kind of thing that might be out there that we only would see under special circumstances where the cumulative effect of this tiny force would produce a measurable effect. So that makes it plausible. I'm still not sure why that wouldn't have also affected, because I mean, I see what you're saying about orbit versus going tangentially away from the sun, but even still, we calculate the orbit of those asteroids based upon the laws of gravity. If there was a another force acting in there, I would still think it would have an effect on those orbits.
Another point, Jay, is that I mean the cause of this force could be something really, really interesting. It could be related to dark energy, perhaps, or how about this? How about it's caused by the effect of some previously undetectable, tiny dimension, you know, some dimension outside of the dimensions we're familiar with. I mean, imagine what could come of a discovery of hidden dimensions. I mean, they've been looking for proof of that for many decades. So that would be just fascinating.
Yeah, well, don't jump to conclusions now. I'm just, you know, bringing up a question.
Yeah.
A little vibration in the membrane theory that's out there, you know, causing this.
We have one more astronomy-related news item. We've been following over the last few years, since we've been doing this podcast, really, the ongoing discovery of exoplanets. And from time to time, we like to report upon the biggest, the hottest, the closest. But the quote-unquote holy grail of searching for exoplanets is finding a true Earth-like planet where life is possible.
Human life.
Well, I think any life.
Even water, you know.
Yeah, which basically means that liquid water could occur on the surface, right? That's really our primary criterion for life could exist on this planet. So once again, astronomers are announcing the discovery of a planet that could be the long-sought-after Earth-like exoplanet. Although I don't think this one quite fits the bill. It is in the so-called Goldilocks range, where surface temperatures could be in the range of liquid water. But this planet is about 3 to 4 times the mass of the Earth. Could be bigger, but you know, it's at least 3 to 4 times the mass of the Earth. That's okay. So it's a small rocky world.
Ish. Smallish.
Smallish.
It's not a gas giant.
It's right, meaning it's not a gas giant, right?
Right. It's close to its star, right?
It's like very close, yeah.
14 million miles away.
It takes 37 days to go around the sun.
Yeah, so a year on that planet is 37 days. It's 14 million miles away from its parent star. We're 93 million miles away, so it's very close. But the star is a
red dwarf. It's a cool
red dwarf.
It's a cool red dwarf, yeah.
Cool.
I mean, you'd go broke just by giving people birthday presents.
You're right. No kidding. Yeah. Birthday,
also, the temperature range, I believe it's tidally locked. So there's one side of the planet's pretty much facing the star at all times. So the range is 160 degrees to 25 degrees. You've got a zone where it's very, very comfortable for people to even walk around. Plus, the other big thing is that it's 20 light years away. It's like right around the corner.
It's in our backyard.
20 light years. I mean, that's nothing.
I'm waving to it right now. Hello.
All right, but here's the thing. So the quote-unquote Goldilocks or habitable zone is based on how hot the star is and how far away the planet is. But that doesn't really – I think actually the zone should also take into consideration the possible atmospheres and also configurations of the planet, right? Because we have as examples Venus and Mars. We have Venus, which is densely cloud covered, and while it's technically in the Goldilocks zone of our system, it's the hottest planet in the solar system because of the atmosphere. Mars is the same way, but Mars has too little atmosphere, and therefore it's always below freezing. But you know, if you had a thicker atmosphere on Mars, it could be Earth-like, or if you had a thinner atmosphere on Venus, it could be Earth-like. This planet is also different than the Earth in that it's tidally locked with its star. So you would imagine there's just a rim or habitable rim around the planet and the border zone between the light side and the dark side, right?
Sounds like a science fiction movie.
And then we have to know, well, what kind of weather is there? Is there, you know, what kind of winds would that generate if you had an atmosphere where one side of the planet's constantly being heated, right? I mean, would that be a very stormy planet?
And Bob, how much would you weigh on that planet?
Well, three times, right? What'd you weigh
Gravity's,
on Earth?
It's 3G. Yeah.
So that would suck.
Well, you'd evolve. To you, it would be normal. You'd evolve to meet those demands.
What do you mean I would? I mean,
if life evolved on that
you
planet,
specifically,
they would be small.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about
like
if we go and
built.
If we have to live on that planet.
It would not be a good planet to live on. Yeah, the gravity being a minimum of three times Earth is rough. And again, you have this little strip, you know, around the twilight zone of the planet where the temperatures would be reasonable. Possibly. Again, the thing may have no atmosphere, and in which case, you know, it would not be habitable, or it may be another Venus, right? It may be shrouded in sulfuric acid. Who the hell knows? But I love all the news reports, like, planet may have life. You know, they're focusing on life. We don't know.
I know, right?
Everyone's going there, though, making that extra extrapolation. Yeah.
But it is cool how we are finding more and more of these planets. That's the cool part about this.
Yeah. We're getting very close to a 1G-ish planet that's really match Earth in all respects.
I think Spock summed it up best when he said class M planet.
Right. Whatever that means.
I think that one of the big considerations, though, Steve, is going to be, you know, how chemically compatible is the planet to us?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, that's asking for a lot, you know, for it to have a right amount of oxygen and not have anything that would be poisonous to us, not have too much CO2. I mean, you know, that's why Star Trek is funny. I mean, they beam, you know, most of the planets just beam down to those planets and they're breathing the atmosphere. I think the probability of beaming down to a random planet, even if it was class M or whatever, and being able to breathe, you know, is pretty remote.
I know, it's ridiculous. Like their big thing is sometimes it's windy on the planet.
Yeah, 1,000-mile-an-hour winds.
I mean, just imagine if the CO2 content was just, you know, 10% instead of, you know, what it is on our planet. You would kill you.
That's why we need nanotechnology. Then we can terraform some of these planets as backup planets.
Ah, terraforming. That's cool.
That's why I agree. I think even if we found a planet that was pretty close to Earth, we're going to need to terraform in order to like actually live outside and have it be a really Earth-like planet.
Yeah, come on. The point to Moon, it would be so damn far away. Even this planet, which is in our backyard, would take a generation ship just to get there. Who the hell wants to do that?
That's a separate issue. Yeah.
We can call the planet Caprica.
When you think about it, we have yet to find an exoplanet that's as habitable as Mars.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
good point.
We will. But I mean, so far we haven't.
Or even Venus, maybe. I mean, we found nothing with that size.
Venus just have to strip away that atmosphere. That's all.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on to who's that noisy?
Yeah, let's get right to it. Should we? Shall we?
Maybe we should.
Do it.
We should. We shall. We will.
All right. Here we go. Last week's noisy.
Science, you are accused of going too far, of befouling, pollutement, and the intoxication of men's minds.
Science has increased our understanding of suffering, but has it really helped?
I like that word, intoxification.
Yeah.
I'm going to start using that in everyday conversation.
So cool.
So,
did you guys know what that was, by the way?
No.
Heard it? You never heard of the show Brass Eye?
I've never watched it.
I never watched it either prior to this when I watched some of it. It was a British television series which did satirical spoof documentaries. It was only on for 1 year back in 1997 on Channel 4 in England. Quite a few people got this correct. Our friend Trinoch from the message boards was the first one to identify it.
I'm shocked.
So that's about the 15th time he's won, I think. So.
Yeah. And we still never get his name right, but that's okay.
Trinoch. In any case, congratulations and well done. Well played. Ready for this week's?
Yes. Hit it.
And here we go.
And we have a winner. It does sound like one of those wheels you spin at the carnival.
Totally. Right? That's good.
Ding, ding, ding.
All right. Good luck, everyone. Thanks, Evan. Let's do one email before we go on to our interview with Bug Girl. She's going to get us all updated on bed bugs. This email is actually a Name That Logical Fallacy, and it comes from Jim Gibo from Algonquin, Illinois. And Jim writes, "There's a type of logical fallacy often used by magicians, creationists, televangelists, and others in the business of deception that doesn't seem to fit cleanly in any of the named categories. I was hoping to suggest a name for what I consider a category unto itself. The logical error I'm talking about is what I call the single cause fallacy. We've all found ourselves arguing with a creationist, and after thoroughly trouncing one of their claims, we're told that our explanation can't be right because it doesn't explain something else. Their intent is to make us look like we're waffling when we're forced to say, no, that was caused by a different mechanism. After several rounds of this, it's easy to make it look like we're the ones pulling explanations out of our collective asses rather than having one coherent theory or dogma that explains everything. Magicians love this tendency. As soon as they've shown that there are no wires attached to their levitating assistant, they know they're free to use all the wires they want for the rest of the act. The audience will assume that there is only one trick being used at a time and ignore evidence to the contrary. I know that this contains elements of the false dichotomy and the non sequitur, and maybe bits and pieces of others. Still, I think this fallacy is common enough and so attractive to purveyors of nonsense that it deserves a name of its own. So what do you say? Do we launch a new meme in the skeptical community? What do you guys think of this?
I don't mind collecting logical fallacies together and giving one a new name as a clarification. Yeah. So it's a cool idea.
Although, I think that Jim should have Googled single cause fallacy first, because it already exists. Single cause fallacy. It's such a good idea. Someone's already thought.
Already thought of it.
It's usually the case.
Yeah, when I was reading, I was like, "Yeah, the single cause fallacy." Yeah, what's he talking about here? So this is in the category of logical fallacies. There is a category of logical fallacies that are false cause fallacies, where there is some logical problem in the way cause and effect is being inferred. So this would include post-hoc ergo propter hoc, you know, after this, therefore, because of this, assuming causation from correlation. But it also includes the single cause fallacy, which is a process of causal oversimplification, which is, again, a heuristic or a cognitive pitfall that humans tend to fall into. We like things to be simple, and we have a tendency to oversimplify. And this is one way in which we do it. We assume a single cause even when there is a complex set of causes. And this can take several forms. It could be to assume, for example, that there is one cause for something, like what is causing the increase in crime, as if there's one cause. Or if somebody committed suicide, why? What's the one reason why that person committed suicide? When in fact there could be many causes, and you can't assume that there's only one cause. Sometimes the oversimplification can result in what we call the false dilemma. Well, is it A or B or C? Well, maybe it's A and B, or maybe A, B, and C. I like his example, though, of the magicians, because they absolutely do that. I remember Randy telling us about that, too. Randy, like other magicians, skeptical magicians, will often do a trick, tell you one way that the trick is done, as if it's the way, right? And then they'll do the trick some other way. That's why he actually cautioned when trying to debunk a fraud, basically, who you suspect is using a magician's trick. You have to be careful to say, this is the way he's doing this trick. Right. Because then they'll do it some other way.
Yeah.
And then it makes them, they could say, no, I'm not doing it that way, therefore right. I'm really psychic. When they could just be doing the accomplishing the trick some other way.
So I can boomerang on you.
Yeah, yeah, you got to be careful. But yeah, so before you invent a name for something, Google it and see what comes up. Well, let's go on with our interview. We are being joined now by Bug Girl. Bug Girl, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey.
And you can't, you just got through telling us that you cannot use your real name.
Yeah.
For some ridiculous reason, but.
It's a state law. It's specifically written for me, actually.
Yeah.
But no, the state views any sort of official person that's employed by the state can't have an opinion because that's lobbying.
Yeah.
And we all know I do have a few opinions.
In other states, we call that censorship.
I say nothing.
I like your Skype icon. It's a bug girl.
It is. That's what I look like.
It's what you would imagine a bug girl looking like.
Yep.
As opposed to a girl bug. Well, bug girl, we have you on tonight because you're going to tell us why we are in the midst of a bed bug epidemic.
Well, I don't know that I can tell you why, but I can tell you some of what to do about it.
Okay.
Because the truth is nobody really knows why. There's a lot of just reasons why bed bugs are suddenly back, but there's no single explanation that satisfies everybody at this point.
Well, what are some of the proposed reasons?
Well, there's a lot of crackpot reasons. We'll just skip over those and go to the ones that seem to have some basis in reality. It's a combination of many different things. Probably the biggest one is that in the 50s and 60s, we were living in the age of chemistry, and we basically nuked the crap out of everything in the developed world, and that had the side effect of killing a lot of bed bugs and getting their population low enough in some places where they just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. So it was not uncommon to call the exterminator and they would, you know, quote unquote, bomb your house.
The chemicals that were in use back then were considerably more toxic.
Yeah.
And
it was DDT for a while, right?
It was DDT for a while. Yeah. And there's a lot of people now that say, oh, if we just bring DDT back, everything would be fine. And that's complete and utter bullshit. Because one of the other reasons why these bugs have come back is that they have developed an astonishing resistance to insecticides. Mm-hmm. And while we're not using the same insecticides that we used in the 50s and 60s, we're using things that are similar enough that the genetic forms of resistance to DDT and some other of the chlorinated biphenyls actually also makes these insects resistant to a lot of things that we use now. And some of the research papers are finding things like 6,000-fold resistance development.
Oh, no.
Yes, mm-hmm. in some insects. And so the biggest problem that we're having is a lot of the tools that we can use just don't work. The third thing that really seems to be responsible is simply that we are in an era when people travel all the time, and we travel amazing distances. Our society in the United States is constantly on the move. And so it's really easy to pick these up. I mean, bed bugs have always been with humans. They found bed bugs in the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
It's really only in the developed world that bed bugs, we had this brief period without bed bugs.
How big are they?
They're quite tiny, and it really depends on how old they are. The thing that makes them so hard to find is that they're incredibly flat when they're not full of blood. So they're about the thickness of a sheet of paper when they're not blimped up with blood. Okay. And so they can hide in incredibly tiny cracks. I mean, you can have them hiding in the slot of a screw on your bed frame, and you would not be able to see them.
Cool.
Those tricky bastards.
They are. Well, they're annoying in a variety of different ways. So as we move things back and forth, it's really easy for us to pick up bed bugs. And then I think the fourth thing that's a part of this is actually the economy. One of the most common ways that people bring bed bugs into their homes, aside from traveling, which is number one, the second most common one is used furniture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody has a bed bug infestation, they put their beautiful, relatively new-looking couch out on the street. And I don't know about you guys, but when I was a graduate student, that's where all my furniture came from, was somebody's curb. In a time where people are stretched dollar-wise, free furniture sometimes turns out to not be as good a deal. Mm-hmm.
So how do they ride along with you? Like, they'll bite you and then you just go home and don't know you have
no,
it hanging
they,
off you?
No, they basically bite you and then just sort of drop off and smoke a cigarette. So they're not like lice, where lice are always on you. They're always riding along with you. So they're carried in things that are near you. So sheets, your backpack, your luggage, furniture, couches. They can get just about anywhere, and they like to stay next to their meals. So typically that's why hotels are a really key place for them, because, you know, that's where everybody sleeps, and it's very easy for them to find lots of different harborages there.
So they'll just stay in the hotel and not, like, follow you home?
If you come into your hotel room and set your luggage on the bed, have you ever done that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Don't do it again, ever.
Oh, okay.
So you guys might want to link to the post I have on my website about how to inspect your hotel room for bed bugs. But the best thing you can do anytime you go into a hotel or you're traveling is when you go in the door, put your suitcase in the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
And then take your room apart and look for bed bugs. Because mm-hmm. the bathtub is a hard, porous surface that's always cleaned. And so that's the one place there will not be bed bugs.
Fascinating.
I'm so
you can also sleep
right
in
now.
The bathtub. Bathtub.
Yeah, I think I'll sleep in the tub.
Is there any health effects to bed bugs?
No, actually, the surprise is they really don't vector any diseases. And it's also kind of interesting that the vast majority of people don't react to them. So a lot of people can be bitten and they won't know. Mm-hmm. It's very idiosyncratic. Some people react to them tremendously and they get huge red welts. And other people have no reaction at all.
Now, it seems recently, though, the controversy is around a newer pesticide called Propoxer. Do you have an opinion mm-hmm. about whether or not we should make exceptions for the use of Propoxer to treat bed bug infestations? The EPA has basically banned it, but some groups want to allow that to be used.
A lot of it relates to the way that EPA deals with pesticides, and there's specific uses that pesticides are approved for. So there are some things that I can spray on my vegetables that I cannot put on my cat, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so part of what they're looking for with Propoxiper is to basically expand the range of where it's used so that in, again, special situations where they cannot get control to possibly use it. And I think that's you know, again, it's one of those, if you can't fix it any other way, what are you going
to
do?
Well, what are some of the basic things that the average person could do to get control of a bed bug infestation or to prevent one short of, you know, using an insecticide?
Well, the best thing you could do is not get the infestation in the first place. And that's often easier said than done. But there are a lot of things that you can do, like being very careful when you travel, not using secondhand furniture or inspecting. If you are getting secondhand furniture, inspecting it very carefully. The other piece is to be aware of what your neighbors are doing. Mm-hmm. And to communicate with them so that if your neighbor gets an infestation, you want to keep an eye on what they are doing because it's very easy for these little insects to travel within an apartment complex. The third thing that you can do is there actually are a variety of different treatments. One of the things that you can do is you can also inspect. If you're moving to a new place, you can have the place inspected. And one of the really interesting little industries that's sprung up is bed bug dogs. So dogs can smell bed bugs with roughly 98% accuracy.
Wow. Yeah,
roughly.
Wow.
I can smell bed bugs, too. To me, they smell like Crayola crayons.
Really? Wait, you really? Can smell bed bugs?
Yeah.
I know some insects have certain scents to them, like those citrusy.
Yeah, but this one, they smell like crayons. They really do.
Wow. But how do you know? What do? You just smell furniture?
Well, I've only smelled them when they're in a jar.
Okay.
Fortunately for me.
Because I was saying, my couch at home, like, you don't want to.
I am not smelling your couch.
Yeah. What? Don't do that. All right, I'll say it. I probably got 20 years of stored up farts in that couch.
I was going to say, Jay has his own gaseous attack that he uses to kill insects in his house.
Yeah,
that
was good.
Call him the flatulator.
Back to the dogs. They're adorable little beagles, and they're very good at sniffing out bed bugs. The other thing that you can try is heat. And so there's been a lot of experiments trying to determine exactly how hot you have to get something before a bed bug kicks off, and also how much you can freeze something. So if you're concerned, if you've been traveling and you're concerned, you can not only heat treat your luggage, you could also heat treat your clothing, a backpack, whatever. And there's also companies that you can hire that will come and heat treat your apartment or your house.
Although
and that's expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say that's quite expensive from what I understand, several thousand dollars.
It depends. It varies widely. The important thing is to make sure that you know, with anyone who is a pest control applicator, you want to make sure that they're licensed, that they are reputable. But if you want to DIY, you can get it up to about 41 degrees Celsius, or that's 105 Fahrenheit. And if you can get it up that hot for 2 hours, that will make them all keel over.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty hot.
Yeah.
You can also get it, if you can get it up to 118 for about half an hour, that'll knock them off too. And that's not hot enough that it should do too much to stuff in your house.
So what if you hit your bed with a hairdryer or something?
You need to get the whole bed. And this is one of the other really interesting things about the thermal experiments is not everything gets hot at the same rate. So they actually had thermometers all through some different... So they had like a chest of drawers and they had measures of how hot things were in the chest of drawers, a desk drawer, inside the mattress, under the mattress. And basically, things just don't heat evenly. So getting the inside of a chest of drawers where you have pants or a rolled-up blanket to those high temperatures, it takes a really long time to get them that hot. And that's one of the reasons why you have to keep it at that high temperature for an extended period. And I just really don't think that you could possibly sit with a heat gun next to your bed.
Yeah.
They just run away and then come back.
And then what about the other end? You said if it gets cold enough, that would do it too. What's cold enough? Just sub-freezing?
Cold enough is 2 weeks in the freezer. If you're using your like regular refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
If you're lucky like me and you have access to an ultra freezer, you can just toss it in there for a day. But not everybody has, you know, a minus 23°C freezer hanging around their house. So
yeah. But if it's wintertime, you could leave your luggage outside.
No, for a very, very long time. If you were in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, yes.
But still, it would take 2 weeks, so just doing it overnight won't do it.
2 weeks of solid freezing.
Yeah, wow.
So many insects are capable of being frozen and then waking back up.
So heat is definitely the way to go.
I'd say heat is the way to go, or if you can toss something in the freezer and just leave it there for a couple of weeks, that would work too. But that you can't really do that with furniture.
Right.
And then we do still have a few things that we can do. So some people use diatomaceous earth, which helps. It's not a cure in and of itself, but used with other programs where you also wash and clean the whole environment, that can be very useful.
How about the dryer? Is that hot enough? You put all your clothes, all your sheets, everything in the dryer?
Might be. It would really depend. If you have an active infestation in your house, you would have to treat all of your bedding and the bed itself and the furniture and the house. I mean, you can find them in, if you have, for example, an electrical outlet next to your bed, they could be in there.
Yeah.
Because it's a nice warm spot with easy access to you.
Now, how do you check for these little freaks?
It's tough because, they don't live on the body. So it's not as easy as lice where it's pretty noticeable. What I do whenever I'm traveling is, the first thing I do is I put my suitcase in the bathtub, and then I explain to the people I'm traveling with why I have put my suitcase in the bathtub. And then I start stripping the bed. Because the easiest thing to do is to look at the bed, because that's where people get bitten. The bed bugs prefer to feed at night. And so what you're looking for are blood stains or fecal blood stains on the mattress.
Mm.
And
how do you tell the difference?
So basically, usually you have clean sheets, and so you have to take all the sheets off. You want to pay attention to the comforter, because a lot of times that doesn't get changed in hotels, and so that's the first potential spot where you could see some of these things. And if you have cats and dogs, you might have heard of something called flea dirt, which is little tiny black specks. And that's basically the blood that the fleas poop out as they're feeding on your pet. And so you're looking for bed bug dirt, which is your blood that the bed bugs are pooping out as they feed on you.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, come on. This is nothing, you guys.
Do you ever see the bugs themselves?
You can if it's bad enough, yes. Usually what you see is evidence that they were there.
Okay.
And
if you're
so
seeing
you'll
actual
see,
bugs, you've got a bad infestation.
You should get the hell out of there, yeah.
You guys taking notes on all this for our upcoming trip? I hope you are.
Yeah.
Hey, I got it all laid out for you in a post. Complete awesome. With pictures of how to take everything off your bed and what you're looking for.
All right, so I just got home from Sweden today. I have not opened up my suitcase, but I did pass out in my bed for 7 hours. Do you think they were on me, or
you're doomed? So, how many of you are scratching at this point?
I did scratch a little.
I've shuffled in my chair a few times.
So, what should I just wash everything in my suitcase? Just throw it in the washer right away?
Sure.
To get it nice and clean won't help the best bugs.
So, Bug Girl, can I ask you about another topic, another infestation, the locusts in Australia, since you're about to head down there?
Oh, you don't want to talk about the truly pervy sex life of bedbugs?
If it really is pervy.
It's pretty freaking pervy, yeah.
I had no idea they were...
They have sex?
I thought it was a standard missionary bug sex.
Oh, no.
Are these the ones that use traumatic insemination?
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Chop the heads off and stuff.
No, that's like something different.
Through the abdomen or whatever. No special orifice of entry, just wherever.
It's literally what it sounds like. Traumatic insemination is just the male, I mean, it's not technically a penis, it's an adiagus, but really, who cares? They have a special little sheath for it that makes it like a knife, and they just stab.
Wow.
The sperm then are released in the female's abdominal cavity, and they just migrate through her body and find the eggs.
And the stab wound doesn't really...
She survives the stab, yeah.
It generally, if she gets stabbed too many times, it starts affecting her. The females, I mean, the whole, it, this actually occurs in quite a few different insect groups, and it seems to have evolved independently at least 3 or 4 different times. But this is another one of those, we don't really know how or why. because it seems like such an incredibly bad idea.
Hey, whatever works. Yeah.
Yes, well, like you should also know that males will also stab other males, and then their sperm will go to that male that's been stabbed, spermatheca, and replace his sperm with the other male's sperm.
Mm, OMG.
Cool. Talk about cock-locked.
Wow. Oh, God.
Yes.
Is that going to make the cut? Awesome.
That has to be.
Oh, boy.
That's a technical term, right?
Yeah, totally is. Yes. Yes.
Interesting. All right, but I do really want to know about the locust infestation in Australia.
Okay.
What do you know about it?
There's locusts in Australia.
And I hear that's an infestation.
There's lots of them.
Of biblical proportions.
Is there a standard biblical unit of infestation?
Well, that's what I was wondering. I've heard also the brown marmorated stink bug is going to be at biblical proportions this year.
The marmorated stink bug?
The stink bugs, yes.
Do they actually stink, and what do they smell
like?
They
stink quite badly, yeah.
They smell like bad crayons?
No, they smell like kind of like a chemical farty smell. It's like if a chemical plant had flatulence, it would be like that.
So it smells like New Jersey.
Yeah.
Rebecca's from New Jersey. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have made that connection.
Okay.
All right then.
All right then. And are there any other insects we need to know about before we go to Australia?
Well, you should know that actually locusts are quite tasty.
I hear that.
There's some actual very interesting, bad taxonomy in the Bible. It's no great shocking news, but generally it's locusts were considered kosher. Mm-hmm. And so they were good to eat. And I've had them quite a few times. They're quite delicious. And so it's...
What do they taste like?
You ate a locust.
I've eaten many, many insects. They're very high in protein. It's the ultimate micro livestock. Yeah. I mean, think about it. This is a perfect way. It's a very high protein source. They don't have cholesterol. It's extremely nutritious. Most people in the world eat insects as a regular part of their diet. We Americans are just namby-pamby wussies, and we can't handle it.
We just haven't found a way to properly market it. That's all.
You know. Have you had chocolate-covered ants?
Bug butter.
Why would I put chocolate on them?
Peanut butter, Jay. Come on. Think about what you're saying.
They're much better stir-fried.
Well, Bug Girl, this has been fascinating. Thanks for coming back on our show.
Thanks for crawling back to us.
Yeah. No problem.
Every time we talk to you, I feel all nasty and itchy.
But in a strangely pleasurable way?
Well, if I itch low enough, yes.
Okay, then. I can live with that.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Sleep
Thank
tight.
You.
Thanks. Don't let the bed bugs bite.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fictitious. We have a theme this week.
Uh-oh.
Would anyone like to guess the theme?
Cars.
Bugs.
Plants.
Close. Animals.
Yeah, I was right.
The theme is animals. Okay, here we go. Item number one. For the first time, scientists demonstrate that some monkeys can recognize themselves in the mirror. Item number two. Scientists discover the first fish that not only gives birth to live young, but that also suckles its young. And item number three. Paleontologists have discovered a 36-million-year-old fossil penguin that stood almost 10 feet tall, making it a contender for the largest bird to ever live.
The 10-feet-tall penguin?
Yep.
Wow, that must have been cool.
Jay, go first.
For the first time, scientists demonstrate that some monkeys can recognize themselves in the mirror. Didn't we already know this? I mean, we know that an elephant did it, right? But I'm sure monkeys did this as well. I'm pretty sure that we already knew this. The second one is about the fish suckling its babies, its young. Why not? Why? You know, I don't see anything weird or strange about that. And paleontologists have discovered a 36-million-year-old fossil penguin that stood almost 10 feet tall. I don't believe that. I think that one's a fake.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, monkeys are recognizing themselves in the mirror. Yeah, that's a problem because chimpanzees have done it, elephants have done it, but monkeys generally have not recognized themselves. Either they get aggressive, they think it's another monkey, or they're not you know, they're not like looking at themselves to learn about themselves, because to show that they know that this is just them and not any other monkey. So that would be interesting that they found some species of monkey that can recognize themselves, or some situation in which it would recognize itself. So the next one is a fish giving birth to live young and suckling its young. That seems odd to me, Jay, because that seems like a mammalian thing to do, not a fishy thing to do. So that does strike me as odd.
Yeah, but there's got to be...
Your time is up. Paleontologists have discovered 36-million-year-old fossil penguin that stood almost 10 feet tall, largest bird to ever live. No, I don't think a penguin is ever going to beat a terror bird for that. Yeah, that just rubs me the wrong way. I don't think penguins were ever. That just seems like too much for a penguin. Oh, look, a ten foot tall penguin. Yeah, I'm not buying that one. I'm going to say the penguin one is fake.
Okay, Evan.
Well, monkeys recognize themselves in the mirror like the other guys. I'm surprised it took this long to figure that out, or have scientists demonstrate it. You ever seen a cat, what a cat does in the mirror? That's fun. That's fun to watch. And then the first fish that not only gives birth to the young, but that suckles its young. Well, it's either the fish or the penguin, a 10-foot tall penguin. How big do emperor penguins get? Like 6 feet tall?
22 feet tall.
Whoa. Some version of the emperor penguin from 36 million years ago. 10 feet. 10 feet tall, standing upright? That's pretty big. I'll take the vanilla way out and go with the guys and say the penguin one is fiction.
All right, so none of you guys believe the penguin one. So let's take these in order. Item number one, for the first time, scientists demonstrate that some monkeys can recognize themselves in the mirror. This one is science.
Oh, thank God.
Cool. So how'd they do it?
Well, it's very interesting, actually. Do you know what test is the standard test to see if an animal recognizes itself in the mirror?
They put a mark on the body.
They put a stupid hat on them, and then
basically, basically that's what it is. It's the mark test. They put a mark on them, and then when they look at themselves in the mirror, do they interact? Do they see that they have a mark on them? Right? Do they interact with it as opposed to reacting to the image as if it were another animal of the same species?
Or looking behind the mirror? You know, like where is he?
They look behind the mirror. So up until now, it's been very reproducible that no species of monkey passes the mark test. They all act as if it's another animal, not an image of themselves. Whereas chimps, orangutans, elephants will do things that will indicate that they recognize that that's them in the mirror. They'll look at parts of themselves that are not otherwise visible. They'll notice the mark on themselves, for example. They won't act aggressively. But researchers who were looking at macaques, doing experiments on macaque monkeys for other reasons, one of the graduate students said, you know, I think this macaque recognizes itself in the mirror. And the other researcher was like, no research has ever showed that. So they did a quick study, and then they actually confirmed that these macaques were behaving in a way that indicated that they recognized themselves in the mirror. They were looking at parts of their body that they would not be able to visualize directly, you know, like bending over or lifting up their legs and things like that.
that had to be funny to see, right?
Yeah, right. Looking at their own junk. But they still failed. This is the interesting bit. They still failed the mark test. So they didn't recognize a mark, but their other behavior indicated that they recognized themselves in the mirror, and then when they covered the mirror with black plastic, those behaviors disappeared, right? There's sort of self-examination, and also one of the monkeys adjusted the mirror to get a better view of itself, you know? So
vain monkey.
This tells us a couple of things. If this is, you know, I think this is the kind of thing that it'd be nice to replicate it, because, you know, sometimes you can overinterpret what animals are doing. But if this holds up, this tells us two things, right? One, that macaques can recognize themselves in the mirror, and that that's thought to be a significant component of self-awareness. So it does make sense that there would be that self-awareness would be a spectrum, right? We don't expect there to be a sharp demarcation line. You go from humans to chimps, and chimps, you know, have this aspect of self-conscious, that they know that they exist separate from the rest of the world, and that that image in the mirror is them. It makes sense that, you know, some monkeys would be able to show some features of recognizing themselves in the mirror, but not others, indicating that we're dealing more with the spectrum, and that it's actually the this evaluation is more complicated than previously thought, and the mark test is not the one marker of self-recognition, you know, in the mirror. So this calls into question a lot of some of the assumptions of that kind of research. They're going to have to explore that in some more detail.
That's awesome.
That's interesting stuff.
Wow. Yeah, it's cool. Let's skip to number three. Paleontologists have discovered a 36-million-year-old fossil penguin that stood almost 10 feet tall, making it a contender for the largest bird to ever live. So here's the thing about this. You guys, you know, you're all imagining a penguin walking around, but, you know, in the water, things can get pretty big.
That's true.
Oh, I didn't
think
of
it that way. Dolphins and whales. You know, that's, there's a reason why whales are the biggest animals in the earth, right?
Yeah.
On the earth. But this one's a fiction.
Hey.
But I just thought it was more plausible than you guys made it out to be. 10 feet tall is as big as the largest bird to ever live, the terror bird, you know, in South America. And paleontologists have found a 36-million-year-old fossil remains of a giant penguin. But this penguin was like 5-6 feet tall.
Okay.
The emperor penguin, by the way, is 5 feet tall. So this thing is like just a little bit taller than an emperor penguin. But what's interesting about it is that it wasn't black and white. They were able to do that analysis that they do on the melanosomes of the bird feathers.
Yeah,
the fossilized preservation of melanosomes. And this is, you know, Jacob Vinther at Yale University was one of the co-authors on this study.
What color was
it? It was like a rusty brown.
Cool.
Yeah, not black and white. So this means that the coloration of penguins was a later development. This thing is that this thing was a penguin. It was a swimmer. Its wings were adapted to as flippers, and its feathers were streamlined like modern penguins. So this thing was a penguin swimming around in the water, but it wasn't black and white. Yet all modern penguins are black and white. So that means all modern penguins evolved probably, you know, evolved from a descendant of this penguin, or not necessarily actually in the direct line of this penguin, but some later penguin that was black and white, right?
Yeah.
But if you go back to the early history of penguins, they at least this species was a different color. So the black and white bit came later. Let's go back to number two. Scientists discover the first fish that not only gives birth to live young, but that also suckles its young, and that, of course, is science. And Jay, you're not impressed with that.
I'm, you know, with such a huge variety of fish out there and all sorts of, you know.
This is the first. We've never, ever discovered a fish before that suckles its young.
I mean, basically what you're saying is that the little baby fish come up to the mother and they basically nurse on the mother.
I'm not saying that, no.
What are you saying?
I'll tell you. You might assume that. That's not what happens. So this is a European eel pout fish. And it was known that this fish, among other fish, there are fish that give birth to live young, not eggs, right? Mm-hmm. But those young are usually born very, very tiny. This is the European viviparous eel pout, right? Viviparous means give birth to live young. It gives birth to much larger fish, and it also has one of the longest known pregnancies, lasting approximately 6 months.
Wow.
Now, that was a bit of an anomaly. Do you know why? That was hard to explain.
Why?
Because the other fish, like guppies, that give birth to live young, their embryos still feed on the yolk from the egg sacs from the mother's body.
Mm-hmm.
But that
Wouldn't be enough left.
Yeah, that only lasts a very short period of time. It wouldn't last 6 months. So the scientists didn't know how the eel pouts were keeping their babies going for 6 months when the yolk would have given out after a week or two. And it turns out that the fish are suckling directly off the mother, but while still inside. So not once they give birth. So for those 6 months, they're internally suckling on the mother.
Oh, okay. So there's the big change up.
Yeah. So the fish has special follicles that they suckle from. That explains the 6 month anomaly and is the first time that's ever been discovered in a fish, which is cool.
And you're angry about this.
No, I think it's cool.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard to bet against, you know, animals surprising us with with new more variation than we previously thought. You know, there's exceptions to every rule in biology, it seems. Animals defy easy categorization because there's always things at the edges that defy those categories, right? Like the duck-billed platypus.
We beat you again, Steve.
You did. Even sleep-deprived. I was hoping to get you guys while you were vulnerable and sleepy.
No such luck.
Jay, give us a quote to close out the show this week.
So I have a quote sent in by Kate Christie, sent in from Moorhead, Minnesota. So Kate said that she's a youth worker with the Boys and Girls Club, and she specifically works with kids in the after-school program. And she said it was towards the end of the day, and I was sitting with a small group of kids playing apples to apples. I forgot what led up to it, but this little boy said, "I believe in aliens." And this little girl sitting next to her said, "Aliens haven't been proven yet. That's scientific."
Mm-hmm. That's the quote?
Yeah, not good enough?
The little girl in her class. Oh, that's fine.
What's wrong with that?
Aliens haven't been proven. That would be a perfectly skeptical quote. Except you got to take the yet out, because that's assuming it will be proven at one point, and we don't make assumptions like that, right?
She's 7 years old.
No, she gets an A-.
Little girl! I have an announcement.
You do?
The announcement is the Granite State Skeptics are hosting a walking tour of Salem, Massachusetts, starting at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, October 3rd. So this is going to be the day after the show comes out. For more info, visit granitestateskeptics.org and specifically ask for Travis Roy.
Travis Roy. Yeah, he's a good guy. Don't forget we're going to be in Vancouver November 20th. Take a look at the CFI Vancouver website. They have information on the event. I don't think they've opened up their ticket sales yet, but they said keep checking back. They'll make the ticket sales available soon, and we will, of course, announce it on the show when they do. But we will be joined by George
Rabb.
Hrab. I've been informed by multiple people that it's George Hrab, not
Sorry,
Hrab.
George. George Hrab.
George Hrab.
George is not just going to be at the event. He's going to be on the panel with us doing the show. And then George will also be playing his brand new acoustic guitar and singing to us at some point during the day.
From his new album?
I'm sure he'll take requests.
That too.
Right. We all got our passports. We're ready to head to Canada and then Australia.
Yeah. And just dreading the 16-hour flight from Canada to Australia.
Vancouver to Sydney,
And the little kid behind your seat, you know, kicking your seat the whole time.
I just did 8.5 hours today, and I was thinking, God, double that flight. But it's worth it. Got to do it.
Oh, absolutely. Come on, we need the space plane, 45 minutes.
Right?
New York to Sydney, 45 minutes with the space plane. That's what we need.
That is worth the CO2 emissions for whatever that plane is chugging out. I mean, that is worth it.
And also the view. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you got to see it. I wonder how scary that flight is. I mean, how vertical is it? You know, it's not like a plane that gradually goes up and down. I mean, they're punching hard.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they're going vertical. If they would even take off from the ground. I mean, if you get a scramjet engine, you can't take off from the ground with using a scramjet engine because you need a certain velocity
for
it to work. But whatever, I still want it.
But if they do it, which I'm sure that someday we'll have it, they've got to have like lots of cool sound effects and stuff. They've got to really push the sci-fi element of the experience.
Yeah, either that or we need the underground tube in a vacuum. You know, they remove all the air. And you just think, you know, that would also get you across the country pretty quick.
I'm not doing that. You're not sticking me in a vacuum tube under the ground. No way.
You'd rather be blasted into orbit by a rocket?
Probably, yeah.
I would, because it seems like such a gargantuan engineering problem to make a vacuum tube that's thousands of miles long. I mean, my God, imagine building that thing.
It's non-trivial.
And, you know, one earthquake and you're cooked.
All right, space plane it is.
Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Yes.
God, we're still recording?
Our pleasure.
Stop.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.